if the FBI agent was just trying to rattle your cage.
How?
If you are a POI, they will put a surveillance package on you. Hopefully they haven't done so already, but the dry cleaning run I sent you on would have shaken them off if they were tailing you.
Again, I didn't see anything.
It wouldn't be obvious, son. There would be a number of cars rotating in and out when you're in your vehicle. Half a dozen men and women, probably more than that when you're on foot. They'll tap your home and office phone, use a court order to get access to your mobile.
Jesus Christ!
Calm down, said Gianna.
Harlan, that would be a worst-case scenario. Let's not make things more stressful than they have to be.
She turned to Ross.
We don't know that they are watching you yet.
Banfield said, here's what we'll do. I'll run you around town a little bit. Just have you go from here to there without a care in the world.
And?
Asked Ross. And I watch out for anyone following you.
Will you be able to?
Of course I will. I didn't just fall off the turnip truck. As I told you before, this isn't our first time dealing with this sort of thing. How soon can we run a little test?
Ross looked at his watch. I'm off for the rest of the day. I have a dentist appointment at 1.
Good. You'll buy a headset so we can stay in communication via your new phone. Go back to your car and go to your appointment. If there is surveillance on you and they lost you, they'll know that's where they can pick you back up. Once you're finished, I'll direct you to a location where I'll be waiting to identify any FBI personnel following you. Ethan nodded distractedly, but Gianna stepped forward and gave him a hug.
Hopefully everything is fine, she said.
To Ethan, this was a massive understatement. But if there are reasons for concern, we will take the steps necessary to keep you safe.
Please, you must relax and trust me.
Ethan looked into Bertoli's eyes. He thought of his mother, even though Bertoli was 20 years younger.
I do.
Banfield said, you're going to have to hurry to make your dentist appointment. Dominic spent half an hour sitting at his kitchen table, loading data from his phone into software on his laptop that would analyze and categorize his find. It was more work for the computer than it was for Dom, so while everything was loading and crunching, he opened his slap-on GPS receiving app on his computer and began tracking Ethan Ross's Mercedes. He saw from the map display that the vehicle had been parked in a lot in Washington Circle for more than 50 minutes. Just sitting there. Dom took this to mean whoever Ross rushed out to meet either lived or worked in the area. If Ross was indeed the traitor, this was seriously bad news, as the options in the area for a man with classified U.S. intelligence and the will to share it with unsanctioned parties were plentiful. Embassy Row was within walking distance to the north, and other embassies and foreign organizations dotted the area. Dom guessed there were more state actor enemies of America in a 10-square-block area around that parking lot than in any other place in the United States. But he realized he was getting ahead of himself, making assumptions based on a lot of speculation. He fought the urge to continue with these assumptions without, at least, checking into some competing theories about just what Ross was doing. He typed in dentist offices in a Google Maps search of the area, and he saw a half dozen within a couple blocks of the parking lot where the Mercedes sat.
Shit.
For all he knew, Ross had simply gone to get his teeth cleaned.
No.
He said it aloud. The bits of the phone conversation he'd picked up back in Georgetown made him near certain Ross was meeting with someone else. Right the fuck now wasn't something someone said to the receptionist at the dentist office. There was an emergency in Ethan Ross's world, and Dom had to figure it involved the investigation into the SS Ardahan leak. Dom knew this wasn't enough evidence for Albright. He wouldn't even reveal what he'd learned because it would only tip the FBI off that Dom was in play and inserting himself into the investigation. He thought about calling David, but he didn't have anything for the Mossad to do at this point. He had a suspicious acting character demanding a clandestine meeting with someone. It wasn't much, but right now it was enough for Dom. He decided he'd keep an eye on Ethan Ross to the best of his abilities. Dom was all alone and couldn't very well tail him effectively. But he decided he might as well try a soft mobile surveillance. He put his shoulder holster back on, checked the lay of his Smith & Wesson under his arm. He then put on a thick black leather jacket and grabbed his motorcycle helmet and his keys. He turned on his phone's app for the slap-on tracker so he could follow Ross if he left the lot while Dom was en route, and then he headed down to his Suzuki TU-250 street bike. Dom arrived at the parking lot in Washington Circle as Ethan Ross climbed out of a taxi just yards away from his vehicle. To Caruso, that looked fishy as hell. Why would he park his car and then cab it someplace else? Certainly he couldn't imagine any scenario that involved a dentist. Dom circled the block to give Ross time to get into his car, and by the time Dom made it back around, Ross was pulling around the roundabout that served as the perimeter for Washington Circle Park. Dom expected him to head west on K Street back toward Georgetown, but instead Ross merged into traffic heading east on K. Dom pulled into traffic several vehicles behind him. He kept himself shielded by the intervening cars and trucks, even though his smoked visor and the sheer distance would have made it impossible for Ross to identify his face, even if he had been looking for surveillance. Dom followed the bright red and easy-to-track vehicle all the way to Chinatown, where Ross pulled into a covered lot a block north of the Verizon Center, paying $11 an hour for the privilege. Dom got lucky and found street parking a block to the south, and he locked his bike while keeping an eye on the exit to the lot. Ross appeared a minute later, but instead of walking into Chinatown, he walked away from it, east on H Street. There were a number of office buildings here, but the NSC staffer just kept walking by entrance after entrance, continuing all the way to Massachusetts. Dom was well behind him and on the other side of the street, careful for any attempts by Ross to detect surveillance. This could have been an SDR, an attempt to see if anyone was on him, but Dom was playing it so soft, he felt safe enough for the time being. Finally, after 15 minutes of walking through the cold, Caruso realized Ross was heading straight to Union Station. His first thought was that his target would descend into the metro just outside of the station, which would have certainly made continued surveillance of him difficult, if not impossible. But instead, Ross entered Union Station itself. He wasn't carrying any luggage, just a leather messenger bag, so Dom doubted he would be skipping town this afternoon. Dom assumed Ross was here to meet someone, either for a perfectly above-board late lunch or for a clandestine meet of some sort. If it turned out to be the former, Dom figured he would just go in and find a location to set up a static watch and keep tabs on the man, maybe see who he dined with. If the latter was the case, if he was here to interact with someone surreptitiously well, Dom was a realist. Union Station was a huge area for one man to cover, with dozens of corridors, shops, restaurants, bathrooms, and trains. Dom wasn't going to stick so close that he would see anything too dramatic. That happened only in the movies. As soon as Ross entered through the door near the metro, Dom headed to the Massachusetts Avenue entrance, then entered into the huge, cavernous main hall. It was after 2 p.m. Most people in D.C. took lunch between noon and 1, so the area was far from crowded. Ross entered from the west hall into the main hall, passing 40 feet from Dominic without even glancing his way. Dom watched him out of the corner of his eye as he walked around the circular center cafe in the middle of the marble floor. Then he headed through a double doorway to the main-level mall concourse of the station. Dom stayed on him, far enough behind that he ran a significant risk of losing him if Ross tried any evasion tactics or dry-cleaning. But he remained close enough to keep him in his sights, as long as Ross kept things simple. And Ross unwittingly cooperated. He entered a bookstore and browsed for a few minutes. Dom stayed across the hall in a clothing store with racks of suits high enough to hide himself, if need be, and he found a mirror that just picked up Ethan while he stood at a book rack across the hall. Ross didn't buy anything, and soon he was climbing the stairs to the shops on the mezzanine level. Dom let him go, deciding instead to wait it out down here on the main level and keep an eye on both stairwells that led up to the mezzanine. If Ross had a meet planned on the second floor, then Dom would be out of luck. But surveillance was a trade-off, and he absolutely did not want to spook this guy and cause him to raise his defenses. Dom positioned himself between the two stairwells up to the mezzanine and pretended to make a phone call while he waited for his target to return. He spent his time watching others heading upstairs, businessmen and businesswomen killing time while waiting for trains that would take them to New York, Baltimore, Richmond, or Philly. Young mothers struggling with strollers on their way to the mezzanine-level shops. An elderly couple moving slowly up the staircase, who were quickly overtaken by two college-aged men wearing tracksuits and backpacks who climbed more quickly. Ethan Ross came down the stairs at the opposite end of the shopping hall a few minutes later. Dom fell in behind him as he headed back up the length of the main floor, then passed by as Ross stepped into a clothing store, crossing a large mirrored wall near the front. As he checked the mirror, Dom noticed for the first time that his target was wearing a Bluetooth headset in his right ear. He didn't seem to be in conversation with anyone, but Dom could not be certain. He also noticed that Ross wasn't on any real surveillance detection route, because at no point did he check for a tail, or even look into the mirrored wall for any easy indication someone was following him. The pieces came together slowly for Dom, but they did come together. The idle wandering around, the utter lack of interest in his surroundings, the headset in his ear. Ross was on an SDR, but he wasn't the one doing the detection. Someone else was here, a confederate of his, watching him, or, more accurately, watching for anyone on his tail. The hairs stood up on Caruso's forearms under his jacket as he thought about enemy eyes on him right now. 23. The more Dom mentally retraced his own steps over the past half hour, the more he convinced himself he'd played his surveillance correctly so far. He'd not followed Ross up the obvious choke point of the mezzanine stairs. He'd let the man come to him in the mall instead of just walking behind him. If Dom had been pinged by the opposition, whoever and wherever they were, then he was certain he'd just been pegged for closer scrutiny as one of many potential tails. He was sure he hadn't tipped his hand definitively that he was a surveillant. Ross walked out of the clothing store now. Again, he hadn't bought a thing, and he headed back to the staircase, this time descending to the food court in the basement. Caruso's first inclination was to back off, to get the hell out of Union Station before Ross's fairy godmother, somewhere close by with eyes on him right now, tipped him off that he was being followed by a guy in a black biker jacket. But as he started to walk, Dom decided his best move was to make it obvious he wasn't a tail by blowing his coverage on purpose. So he walked to the staircase, caught up with Ross, and then passed him going down, nearly brushing against him as he descended. It was such an overt move that, Dom determined, he would be discounted as a potential watcher by anyone who saw him. In the food court, Dom got in line at a gyro stand. For nearly 3 minutes, he willed himself to look straight ahead, hoping that anyone suspicious of him was watching him the entire time, noting his complete lack of interest in anything other than his lunch. He ordered a lamb kebab and a Coke and paid for them, then waited while his order was prepared. All the while, he looked ahead at the gyro stand or down at his phone. Only when he had his food in hand and found a plastic chair and a little table by the center staircase did he glance up and out at the big room. It was just a quick peek, and then he looked back down to his lunch. But Dom had been trained to use a single glance to take a still picture of his surroundings with the camera in his brain. As he began eating, he processed the photo he just took. There were the 50 or so tables in front of him, the food stalls going down the right-hand side, the hallway to the restrooms on the left, and there, facing away and heading toward the restrooms, was Ethan Ross. Dom looked up again as he took a sip of his Coke, keeping his gaze relaxed and natural. Ethan disappeared down the hall to the men's room. There was no way Dom would follow him, even if he didn't suspect Ross had a spotter somewhere in this room watching his back. The hallway was another choke point the spotter would send Ross down to ID an overzealous tail. Nope. Dom decided he'd let his target piss on his own. Caruso ate another bite of food, but stopped chewing suddenly when he saw something curious in front of him. A man in his 30s, and wearing a charcoal gray suit and an overcoat, walked toward the bathroom hall to the men's room. There was nothing particularly interesting in that, but Dom noticed the man exchange a quick but unmistakable look with two young men sitting at a table eating pizza. On second glance, Dom realized these were the two college-aged men in tracksuits he'd seen heading up to the mezzanine behind Ross 10 minutes earlier. Charcoal suit man didn't look like he was with the college boys. They certainly hadn't been together earlier, but the glance was one of insecurity, concern. To Dom, the look said, "Should I follow him in?" After the look, the man did, in fact, head down the hallway to the bathroom. Dom had been on the passive lookout for Ross's spotter, but he knew these guys weren't working with Ross. The glance said something else. They weren't Ross's fairy godmothers. This was a tale. Dom corrected himself. This was another tale. This had to be the FBI conducting surveillance on Ross, and this infuriated Caruso. He wanted to punch his fist into the wall next to him, but he fought the urge. He knew good and well that Ross's spotter would have seen the man he'd funneled into the choke point, and this meant Ross would now spook and go to ground, making proving anything against him much more difficult. Dom took out his phone and dialed a number he'd saved in the memory. After a few rings, a man answered. "Albright," Caruso whispered, though there was no one around.
"Damn it, Darren. Your boys are fucking up."
"My boys? What boys?"
"Listen to me. The tail on Ross has got to pull back. He's running an SDR, but he's got a spotter. Your team is trying to stick too close to him. Shit, I'm 90% sure it's already too late. One of them just got dragged through a choke point."
"Where are you?"
Dom sighed. "I'm at Union Station, the food court."
"You are following Ethan Ross?"
"A hell of a lot better than your team is following him."
"I told you before. You are to stay out of the investigation, and you agreed to that. On top of that, he's not even a subject of inquiry."
"If he's not a subject of inquiry, why do you have a tail on—"
"We don't have a tail on him." Dom watched the two young men at the table as they stood and headed for the stairs, drifting through the light crowd. Dom expected they would go up and find a static watch location for when Ross ascended. Dom asked, "Then who the hell are these guys?" Albright did not respond to the question, Instead, he said, I want you to go home. I'll come over later and talk to you about this.
The tail on him isn't FBI. You're 100% certain?
I am disinclined to discuss any part of the investigation with you at this point, since you obviously haven't held up your end of our bargain. But just so you will back off and not harass any civilians who are presumed innocent, I can positively confirm, on my mother's grave, that I do not have any surveillance package of any kind on NSC staffer Ethan Ross.
What are you going to do about these guys?
I suggest you contact the NSC. If there is a security issue involving one of their employees, they need to take care of it. Albright hung up the phone. Dom rolled his eyes. Clearly, Albright didn't believe Caruso's concerns were valid. The two young men were out of sight now, but Dom thought about their appearance. They both had dark hair and somewhat olive complexions, but they could have been from just about anywhere save Scandinavia. The man in the charcoal suit had salt-and-pepper hair and lighter skin, although he wasn't exactly fair either.
There were really no definitive conclusions he could draw about them from their appearance.
Ross appeared from the bathroom hallway, and Dominic looked down at his food. When he looked up again, 30 seconds later, Ross was gone. He'd apparently ascended the other staircase, on the far side of the basement from where Dom now sat. Dom did not go after him. There was already too much going on around here for his taste, so he decided he'd just finish his lunch and go home. He took a bite of the kebab, but realized he'd lost his appetite. Thinking about Ross, the fact he had Confederates, the fact he now knew he was under suspicion and he would now act in a way that might well make him safer for it, churned Dominic's stomach. He stood and dumped his leftovers in a nearby garbage can, then headed toward the stairs closest to him. Just in front of him, a thick-set older man in a camel-wool coat turned to take the stairs, and Dom had to slow to let him pass. Dom had just taken his first step up when he looked above him, past the older man, and he noticed a pair of uniformed D.C. Metro police officers descending. One spoke into the microphone attached to his epaulet, and both men moved purposefully, as if they were being dispatched downstairs on a mission. Almost instinctively, Dom turned around and began walking away from the stairs. He knew instantly that Darren Albright had called the local police. Not to grab Ross. Not to grab the guy spotting for Ross. Not to grab the men following Ross. But to grab Caruso.
Fucking Albright, he mumbled to himself.
He walked past the hallway to the restrooms on his left, and he continued to the stairs at the west end of the basement. Just before he reached them, he turned away quickly and pretended to use an ATM on his right, keeping his back to the stairs. Two more Metro PD came down the west staircase and passed him unaware. After they moved on into the room, Dom spun away and shot up the stairs, then out of Union Station. Just as Dom had suspected, Ethan Ross's fairy godmother had spotted the men on his tail. Harlan Banfield had sat in the food court, at a bench alongside a creperie ahead of Caruso, but out of his view on the other side of a support column. The moment he saw the men, Banfield ID'd them as FBI. This was confirmation bias. Ross thought the feds were onto him. Someone was, in fact, onto him, so Banfield presumed it was the feds. He was in constant communication with Ethan, but he did not tell him he was being followed. Instead, Banfield told Ethan to begin walking back to his car in Chinatown, and he would tell him what to do next. Once Ethan was out of the bathroom and taking the stairs out of the basement, Harlan headed to the staircase closest to him, rushed past a young man in a motorcycle jacket, and climbed up. A pair of D.C. police were heading down, but Banfield didn't pay any attention to them. He was already thinking about what to do next with Ethan Ross. As he headed back to his motorcycle in Chinatown, Dom fished through his pocket and pulled out the card the Mossad officer gave him the previous morning. He dialed the number, and David answered on the first ring.
Mr. Caruso, so good of you to call. How can I be of service?
Do you have surveillance on someone here in D.C.? David chuckled.
That is a vague question. Of course we have someone under surveillance. Syrian diplomats, Palestinian radicals, Egyptian military attachés. Your capital city is a surprisingly hostile environment. I presume, however, you are referring to someone specific.
Someone who might have been involved in the NSC breach. David answered unequivocally.
Absolutely not. As I told you, we are hoping you might help us with that. We have other feelers out, of course, but so far, nothing solid. If you are telling me you already have a suspect, I will be most impressed.
Well, I do have a suspect, and he's got a tail.
FBI?
The FBI says no.
That's interesting. Some other actor is following him?
It appears so.
What is this man's name?
I'll look into it on my end.
Dom hesitated.
No, he wasn't ready to get the Mossad involved in this. They were just one more moving part to a situation that was quickly becoming extremely complicated. Dom decided it was better he kept them at arm's reach. For now, anyway.
It's just a hunch. I'll let you know if I find out anything more.
If you say this man is under surveillance, then that makes him more than a hunch.
Involve us, Dominic, and we can use our resources to vet him.
I'll call you back. Dom hung up the phone and kept walking.
David was right. Ethan Ross was more than a hunch.
But for now, all Dominic could do was try to think of a way to convince Special Agent Albright of this fact.
24.
After an hour of Ross's browsing through several malls and chain stores in a very natural-looking dry-cleaning run, Banfield saw no more sign of any surveillance on his whistleblower. Still, it was clear to Banfield that the FBI was, at least, attempting to monitor Ross's movements. At 3:30 in the afternoon, he called Ethan and told him to go to an underground parking garage in Columbia Heights. Here, Ethan climbed into Banfield's car, and together the two men drove through rush-hour traffic to the Ritz-Carlton on 22nd Street, where they parked in the underground lot below the hotel. While Ethan waited in the car, Banfield went alone up to Gianna Bertoli's two-room suite, checked the area and the route up a back stairwell, and then returned to shepherd Ethan up with him. The three turned the volume on the television high, and they ran the water in the bathtub and the shower, and then sat close together on chairs in the living room of the suite. Bertoli had no real suspicion she was under surveillance, but as the director of the International Transparency Project, she'd learned to take a number of necessary steps to ensure her privacy. Only when they were all seated with wine from the minibar in their hands did Banfield inform Ross he was, without a doubt, under surveillance by the FBI. Ross's eyes glazed over. Bertoli asked,
"You are certain, Harlan?"
"Yes. I identified at least three men following him through Union Station. We slipped away from them after that, and he was clean by the time I picked him up. But the tale was real."
"Shit," mumbled Ethan.
Banfield turned to Ethan and brightened a little. "That's the bad news. The good news is I checked with another of my whistleblowers, and this person has access to U.S. federal employee files. I had her look into NSC employee records, and there are no new flags or security holds on badges or computer access of any staff member. That makes me think the surveillance on you is very preliminary. They are suspicious, and they'll keep digging, but for now, they don't have enough to go on to do anything more than put a tail on you." As far as Ethan was concerned, Banfield was just sugarcoating it. Ethan felt his entire life slipping away from him. His family would not understand. While his parents would be sympathetic with the ideological reasons behind his actions, they were ex-government hacks, and they would think him a traitor like the rest of the world. He leaned back in the chair and stared into space. Bertoli knelt on the floor next to the young NSC staffer, hugging him in sympathy, as if the two had known each other for years. Ethan spoke into the softness of her curly hair.
What am I going to do?
She put her arm on his shoulder and held it firmly.
For now, you need to act naturally.
Albright is going to talk to Eve, and he is going to lean on her. She'll tell them she told me about specific system vulnerabilities, and then they will arrest me. Bertoli said,
You are in a serious situation. I do not want to minimize it. But it is not dire. Not yet. The problem is, when it becomes dire, it will be too late for you to help yourself.
What does that mean?
There is something you need to do. And you need to do it now.
You're talking about the damn scrape again?
Yes. Harlan just said you still have access to your system. Go in to work tomorrow morning and download the files, then secure them whatever way you think is best, just in case you need your ace in the hole.
He shook his head. I'll just dig my hole deeper. Better I take my chances now. If they arrest me, I'll get the best lawyer money can buy, and I'll make as much noise as I can. Maybe if I'm lucky...
Bertoli put her hand on Ethan's cheek. My poor, naive Ethan. If they catch you, you won't be famous. There won't be a big trial for you to air your grievances.
Ethan said, This is America. They'll have to put me on trial. She shook her head.
No. They will psych you.
Psych me? Deem you a security risk, and then put you in a psychological facility, fill you up with meds, give you sort of a chemical lobotomy.
They will forget about you. Everyone will forget about you.
With a rueful smile, she said,
The worst part is, you will forget about you.
Ethan had heard rumors along these lines, but he'd never believed them. But Bertoli seemed utterly credible. He found it impossible to doubt her.
What do you propose?
Banfield said, You make your scrape, then you get out of town. Some place far away so you can avoid arrest and set things up on your terms, not theirs.
I could go to my mom's in San Francisco.
Bertoli shook her head.
No, Ethan. I am talking about going abroad. I'm talking about asylum.
He put his head in his hands.
Asylum?
No. God, no. He mumbled to himself, his eyes distant like a victim of shock, as the weight of his predicament crashed down upon him. The NASCAR drive appeared in her hand, and she folded it into his. He did not resist. Once again, she said,
If you wait until you need it, it will be too late.
Banfield leaned closer too. Through my contact, I will know if your access is blocked. That will be our indication that the FBI is planning on making an arrest, but again, it will be too late then. Ethan put the crawler in the pocket of his jacket and stood up.
I don't know.
I need to think about it. Bertoli let the worry on her face show, but she said,
Okay, I understand.
Harlan and Ethan left Gianna a few minutes later, slipping out the back stairs and down to the parking lot. As the two men drove out of the neighborhood on the way to drop Ethan at a taxi stand in Petworth, Ethan decided he would talk to Eve to get a feel about just how bad things were. If she had been interviewed by Albright, if the situation seemed utterly hopeless, then he would go to the office tomorrow morning and steal secrets to use as a bargaining chip. But he'd do it only if he had to. He told himself he was still in control, not Banfield, not Bertoli, not Albright. He would do what was best for him. Ethan believed in nothing more than he believed in his own intellect, and he still thought he could game this seemingly hopeless situation into something else. Not a victory for him, perhaps. That was too much to hope for. But maybe a draw. A détente between the parties. Ethan Ross had faith in his brilliance. He'd get through this somehow, and come out on the other end intact. Dom Caruso sat on his couch with a half-empty bottle of Harp beer in his hand. The TV was off, his computer was shut down and in another room, and he'd straightened his living room to some small degree, because he expected company soon. In the quiet of the moment, he made a mental survey of his injuries. The headaches had gone away. He was thankful for that. He felt the tightness in his rib cage still. The pain had lessened greatly, but the spasm remained constant, and the ache of bruised tissue rose and fell with every breath. The cuts to his arm and chest were healing. He'd probably not rebandage them after his next shower, even though they would look pretty nasty for a few more weeks. Dom had a little experience picking up knocks and dings. He was tough enough to shrug them off mentally long before they disappeared physically. The knock at his door came about when he expected it to. Even the nature and temperament of the knocks, four thundering angry bangs, sounded just about as he had imagined they would. He didn't get up from his couch at first. Instead, he sipped his beer, leaned back on his sofa, and waited for the next set of furious knocks. No sense in rushing what was to come. After several more bangs, he heard, "Caruso!" "It's open," Dom answered back. Darren Albright entered a moment later. He wore a dark blue suit with no overcoat, and his hands were empty. He shut the door behind him, saw Dominic sitting on the sofa, and all but stormed over to him. "Have a seat." Dom pointed to a leather chair, but Albright ignored it. "We had a deal." "I thought of it as more of a gentleman's agreement."
"And you're not a gentleman?"
"There's a time for that, sure. This just isn't it." Albright heaved, as if summoning the strength to continue talking to a disobedient child. He sat down and leaned forward. "I can't have you interfering with the investigation. Ethan Ross is just one of many potential subjects in this. It's going to take some time and some good field work to narrow down the actual culprit. Anything that can jeopardize a good arrest is going to..." "I think he's your man." "If you know something that leads you to that conclusion, I'd like to hear it." Dom opened his mouth to speak, but Albright held a hand up quickly. "Unless, of course, what you say might compromise this investigation or make a successful prosecution impossible. I can't know what you and your spook buddies have done to violate Ross's Fourth Amendment rights, for example. If it's inadmissible in court, which I guess is probably the case with every goddamn thing you guys do, then do me the favor of keeping me the fuck out of it." Dom closed his mouth. He had nothing to say now. Albright noted this.
"Great. That's just fucking great. I'm gonna just play like I don't know you and your people conducted some sort of unreasonable search and seizure."
"Unreasonable search and seizure? Reciting buzzwords from the Fourth Amendment isn't going to help you catch your man." Albright launched out of the chair.
"But it will help me convict the guilty party. That's all that matters to me. I can see it in your eyes, Caruso. This is personal. Very personal. But when an off-the-books spook makes things personal, law and order are the first things tossed out the window."
Who says I'm an off-the-books spook?
I've looked at the books.
You aren't on them. I'm an FBI agent. I draw conclusions. Look, you and I swore the same oath when we joined the Bureau. We affirmed that we would support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Last time I checked, the Fourth Amendment was still part of the Constitution.
Dom said, yeah, well, our tactics are different, but we're both after the same enemy.
Albright fired back.
You're after Ross. I don't know that he's the enemy.
You still have no idea who was tailing him in Union Station?
I do know. Caruso brightened up quickly.
Who? You!
Now Caruso dropped back on the sofa and rolled his eyes. Are we going to get past that? I'm telling you, someone else is interested in Ross.
Albright seemed to take the idea seriously, for the first time. If he did have a tail, then maybe it's the Israelis. They've got feelers out around the Hoover building. They want answers. Maybe they found out he was one of the people we were looking at, so they're doing their own surveillance.
Caruso shook his head.
No.
No?
You'll have to trust me on that.
Right now, I don't trust you on much of anything.
Dom thought about what he should say and what he should leave out. Finally, he spoke slowly, with obvious care.
The Israelis approached me the other day, asking questions. They lost a good man, and they are pissed. They wanted to see if I had any intel. I didn't, but it was clear they didn't either.
How do you know they haven't found out about Ross some other way?
Trust me. They are flailing. They don't know about Ethan Ross. Whoever is following him is working for someone else. I don't know who it is, but unless one of the other 30 or 40 potential leakers in the NSC both gamed their polygraph and have a mysterious entity on their tail, then Ethan Ross just might be your best bet right now.
Albright conceded the point with a slow nod. He said,
all right.
Here's what I'll do. If you back off, and I mean back all the way off, then I'll put a surveillance package on Ross.
Dom asked, when?
You are a pushy son of a bitch.
I can get it in place by AM tomorrow.
Why not now?
Because it takes time.
You are FBI, or at least you pretend to be, so you know that.
If I was absolutely certain Ross was the man, if I knew he was in play with fresh intel, then yeah, I'd pull resources from everywhere and get surveillance set up in nothing flat. But I don't know any of that. I'll go back to the office right now and talk to SSG and technology and everyone else I need to talk with to put the tap and tail in place.
They better be good. He's already nervous.
Don't worry about SSG. They're the best.
That was debatable, Dom thought, but he didn't say. They were good, that was not in doubt, but Dom suspected a few other American agencies had surveillance personnel who could give them a run for their money.
Again. Albright pointed a finger at Dom. I'm not doing a thing until I get your word you won't interfere. And not your word as a gentleman, because that ship has sailed, but your word as a guy who knows he'll get his ass arrested if I see him anywhere around Ethan Ross. I don't give a shit that your uncle is president. Your dad could be the Pope, and I'd still frog march your ass if you pull any more of your shit.
Dom stood and extended a hand.
I promise. I'm out of this. It's up to you guys now.
Albright shook Caruso's hand, reluctantly, because he was still annoyed, and he headed out the door on his way to the Hoover building.
Dom could see it on the FBI special agent's face.
Albright knew he was in for a long night.
25. Ethan took a cab to a bar on M Street a few blocks from his house, then walked the rest of the way to his neighborhood. He arrived at a quarter till midnight and stood across the street in Volta Park for several minutes, watching his place from a distance, looking for any surveillance in cars or windows or trees. A satellite TV van was parked on Q Street just north of his place, and this caught his eye and unnerved him. He'd seen enough TV and movies to know FBI surveillance often parked in disguised vans right in front of their target location, and he wondered if inside the dark, still vehicle, three or four men sat at computer banks with headsets on, just waiting for his return. But after 10 minutes shuffling in the dark and cold in the corner of the park, Ethan watched as a man wearing the uniform of the satellite TV company exited the home of a neighbor, chatted with the lady in the doorway for a moment, and then climbed inside the van. He drove off down the street and disappeared. Satisfied, and somewhat surprised that his place was not being watched, Ethan stepped up to his house and entered through the front door. As was his custom, he crossed the dark living room to the security keypad to turn off the alarm before he flipped on the lights in the living room. But as he got to the keypad, he realized his alarm had been deactivated. Again? He stood there in silence, a little light from the street lamps on 34th Street filtering through the blinds and across the floor, but the house was otherwise dark. He took a step toward the lamp on the table by the sofa, then he stopped suddenly. He sensed a presence there in the room with him. He froze. His voice cracked when he spoke. Who's there? What have you done? It was Eve. Her voice low and flat, the tone both lamenting and accusatory. The terror he felt thinking he was about to be arrested by Albright washed away quickly and was replaced by the knowledge that Eve Pang was now suspicious of him. What did she know? What had she told the FBI? He stepped over to a small lamp on an end table by the wall and flipped it on. There, on his couch, sat Eve Pang, still dressed for work in a long black skirt and a white blouse, her hair back in a bun and her cat-eye glasses on her face. He'd rarely seen her when she was dressed for work. Invariably, she wore her hair down and her contacts in when they went out on a date, and either sweats or his dress shirts when they were in. He found her serious and professional look as disconcerting as her voice. Without speaking, he sat down on the chair across from her, still wearing his ski jacket and his car keys dangling from his fingers. He smelled alcohol. Vodka, he thought. But he didn't see a glass or a bottle, so he guessed she must have consumed a lot for it to be emanating from her skin. "Where is your car?" he asked. "I parked in back, so you wouldn't know I was here." "Why? Where is your car?" Ethan cleared his throat. "I took a cab. I watched you through the window." "No cab." "I had a flat tire."
"Lies. You are lying. You have been lying to me all this time."
"What?
No.
The FBI came to talk to me today." Ethan nodded. So Albright had told the truth. He said, "They don't have any suspects in this leak case, so they're trying to manufacture one. It won't work. They just picked me because they know you're a security specialist. They think maybe you might be involved somehow. I told them that was crazy."
"I am involved, aren't I?"
"Of course not." She shook her head, and a single tear dripped from her eye and ran along the inside of the frame of her glasses.
"The FBI man told me how the breach was perpetrated. Someone logged in as the domain administrator from the NSCJ Wix portal. Just exactly the insider threat vector I told you about. You got me drunk and..."
She started crying.
Her dispassionate professional visage disappeared completely now. You got me drunk all those times. I thought we were having fun. I thought you loved me. I thought that was just what lovers do here in America. But it was all just to make me talk.
Ethan's initial shock of the moment had given way to a cold calm. He told himself he could negotiate his way out of this.
That's not true. The FBI has put this shit in your head. You can't let them make you think those things. They will turn you against me.
Ethan's eyes narrowed.
What did you tell them?
She was openly sobbing now.
I told them they were wrong. I had to, didn't I? I can't let them catch you, Ethan. That will destroy everything I have worked so hard for. You have already broken my heart. I will not let you ruin my life, my future.
Calm down, Eve. You're being dramatic. I didn't have anything to do with the breach.
When I told you about using the domain administrator logon, I didn't tell you about the spot audit record that's done on it. I just didn't think about it. I don't know why. It turns out that was the one mistake the leaker made. And any real computer systems expert who logged on as the domain administrator would have known about it.
No. The person responsible for the breach had the credentials to get access. She cracked a sad little smile.
But not the expertise.
Ethan's jaw clenched tight, and he squeezed his car keys till his fingers turned white.
You don't know what you're talking about.
She took off her glasses and began wiping her eyes with the tissue in her hand. Ethan could see in her eyes now that she was intoxicated. She said,
I thought you were smarter than this. Why would you be a traitor? Fools are traitors. Men caught in traps.
Ethan stood up, trying to control a growing fury. She continued,
I know what trap you were caught in. A trap of your own making. You overestimated your intelligence. You overestimated your importance.
I don't have to listen to this, he said. I'm leaving. I'll get a hotel. You can stay here tonight. You're too drunk to go anywhere.
This took Eve by surprise. She launched to her feet. No, you aren't leaving. I'm not finished talking to you.
But Ethan had already opened his front door and was out on the stoop. She followed him out, grabbed him by the collar. Ethan saw a lone, dark-colored sedan roll up an otherwise dark and empty 34th Street. He turned from it as he pushed Eve back inside roughly, but he faced the sedan again as he headed to the stairs off his porch. The sedan pulled to a stop in the street right in front of him. The driver's side window lowered. Ethan assumed some meddlesome neighbor or passerby had seen him shove a girl, and he was about to get yelled at. He'd yell right back. But from inside the car he heard, Ross! Ethan stopped at the top of the steps. Eve charged out of the house and up behind him again, frantic.
Talk to me, Ethan. Tell me why.
She screamed it through blubbering sobs. But Ross was not listening. He only saw the gun now, because the driver extended his arm out of the darkened interior and the gun was in his hand, and the metal barrel reflected light off the street lamps. The barrel rose, aimed directly at Ethan, at a distance of just 30 feet.
Please!
Eve screamed as she grabbed his shoulder from behind. Ross ducked. A flash of light from the barrel of the gun, then a hollow snap that echoed up and down the street, no louder than a slammed car door. Ethan crouched on his stoop. Behind him he heard a gasp of surprise, and then a crash on the hardwood floor of his living room. But he didn't turn to look. Instead, he watched the gun barrel disappear back inside the vehicle, and then the sedan accelerated calmly, still heading north on 34th. It disappeared in seconds. Ethan turned to find Eve Pang on her back on his living room floor, her hands by her sides, blood expanding from the center of her chest, reddening her white blouse.
Eve!
He crawled to her, but only after checking back over his shoulder for the sedan once more. He pulled her farther into the house and shut the front door, then knelt over her. Her eyes were closed, her face slack, her body small and still. He crawled to the window now, peeked out through the blinds to the street, but all seemed perfectly quiet, as if the neighborhood had no idea there had just been an assassination attempt on a high-ranking White House employee in their midst. Ross was certain of only two things. One, the bullet that had killed Eve had been meant for him, and two, all his options had run out. He needed to execute the scrape. He climbed to his feet, took Eve by the arms and dragged her on the hardwood floor, pulling her behind the sofa. He left her there, then found her purse on the peninsula in the kitchen, right next to an open bottle of Grey Goose and a glass of melting ice. He dug through the purse, found her car keys and her house key. Then he dug some more and pulled out her two-part authentication security fob that said Pang, DDA. He slipped it into his jacket pocket, locked the front door, and headed out the back of his house to Eve's car. Ethan arrived at Eve's Bethesda house on foot after parking her car at a restaurant 6 blocks away and then walking the rest of the way, all the while looking out for strangers on the street. As he had done at his own house an hour earlier, he watched her place from across the road. But when a light rain began to fall, he cut his reconnaissance short and entered through the back door, feeling his way through the dark until he found a pink Hello Kitty flashlight Eve kept on top of her refrigerator. He used this to make his way to the ground floor spare bedroom she used as an office. Her laptop was there, set up like it always was. Next to it were a teacup and a bag of cookies. Eve often worked here late into the night when she wasn't spending the night with Ethan. He put his hand on the cold cup, ran his fingertip around the rim. Ethan was not a sentimental man, but he couldn't help feeling a twinge of sadness about Eve. Still, his mind drifted quickly from this as he considered the attempt on his life that she had the misfortune of stepping in the way of. Ethan thought the assassin must have been an employee of one of two possible groups, the CIA or the Israeli Mossad. In the warped sense of justice of both groups, he could imagine they would have motive to target him if they somehow knew what he had done. Ethan wondered if Eve had let something slip earlier in the day during her FBI interview, something that filtered to the spies and assassins Ethan had fought against by stealing the Peace Flotilla files in the first place. Yes, that must have been what happened. It comforted him a little to think Eve might have had some hand in her own demise. It felt as if everyone was out to get him, as if the walls were closing in on all sides. He thought of prison. He thought of psyching. He thought of the assassins out there who might have thought they had succeeded in silencing him, but soon enough would come to the realization that he had survived. Ethan shook the thoughts out of his head. No time for that now. Now was the time to create value for himself. And to do this, he had to act. Ethan knew the password to Eve's laptop, having obtained it through social engineering. They'd been cooking dinner one night, using a recipe Eve had found online for lobster Newberg in puff pastry, and her laptop had been stationed on the island in the middle of the kitchen so they could both follow along. The screensaver came on while Eve was carefully removing the delicate pastries from the oven. Her hands were full, and Ethan had seen an opportunity. He'd insisted she unlock her machine that instant because he needed to know without delay whether the egg yolks should be beaten before or after adding the brandy. Without looking up from the oven, Eve had shouted out an 8-digit alphanumeric code that Ethan had used to unlock the screen, then committed to memory long enough to add it as a note on his smartphone when he went to the bathroom. He'd test